Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
Hello, I'm Lyndon Terracini, Artistic Director of Opera Australia, and you're listening to The Fool and the Opera.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 Joycast. In this Joycast, you'll hear a summary of the weekly program. Due to copyright restrictions, the music has been edited to make this Joycast possible. For more information about the music played during the show, please visit the blog at joy.org.au/thefoolandtheopera.
Welcome to another episode of The Fool and the Opera. Of course, as you know by now, I am Dan Vo, the fool part of The Fool and the Opera, because we talk about the opera, and it's pretty obvious, isn't it? Now, of course, on today's program, as Gary Wilson, who, lovely Gary Wilson, who read the news just before, he mentioned that, yes, the theme on today's program is rings, but you know that I don't like to just have one particular theme. I like to have a whole sort of sentence structure of the theme for the show. So it is, of course, today One Ring, Family Ties, and The Great Escape. On today's show, we sit down with and have an extended chat with Lyndon Terracini, who is the newly appointed Artistic Director of Opera Australia, which was quite exciting to have him in. Well, not have him in, but he was on the phone, but to have a chat with him about what he sort of sees for opera in Australia going forward in the future, and just to sort of see what his thoughts are, to sort of see the man behind the suit, I suppose. And we did end up talking about his exciting bid to stage The Ring in Australia, and also his wish to collect a library of Australian works and to engage new audiences, which is something that we always love talking about on this program. We also did, of course, mention about the fact that, you know, there's family feuds and there's family ties as well that bond the whole organisation together. So we mentioned that and had a chat with him about that as well. And of course, we also found out why exactly he is called the barbecue baritone, which is kind of interesting. Now, with all the talk about Wagner's The Ring, of course, we do have to play some Valkyrie-based music, but, you know, I am doubtful of the fact that The Ring in Wagner's operas, the four operas that make up the Ring, the Ring cycle, I am doubtful as to whether it is the most almighty ring out there. So we have done a bit of a search for another ring, the one ring to rule them all. The promo that I had for the program was, you know, the one opera to rule them all. But what we do is we peer into our Palantir and cast our gaze over the lush plains of a distant land called Wellywood in search of a voice bearer of one of the most beautiful pieces of music that I had heard when I first heard it. It was just absolutely gorgeous. So we're going to search for that voice, and you might actually be pleasantly surprised with where the ultimate location of our wonderful voice bearer lies. So, you know, I think that that's slightly cryptic, but at the same time, I haven't given anything away. But the thing is, it lies in the west somewhere. I'll let you ponder that as we play the next song. As I mentioned, we will have to play something with the Valkyries in it. The Ride of the Valkyries being one of the most, I suppose, famous pieces of music, and it's usually quite closely related with armies. And I suppose that if you've seen, I can't remember what the film is. If you remember what the film is, you can SMS 0427 Joy949. You can give Jerry a call, Moonwalking Jerry, on 9699 2949. And there's also the email onair@joy.org.au. Now, the film was, I think it's an Oliver Stone film. It's set in Vietnam, and as the soldiers go to raid a village, they play the Ride of the Valkyries pumping from their helicopter. I think it's a Black Hawk. No, it wouldn't be a Black Hawk. They didn't exist back then. But anyway, I wanted to find a piece that has direct connection to an army. And so what better sort of connection to have an army band play the song? This is Rule Britannia, the album, and it's the band of the Parachute Regiment. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9, and you'd expect that to be followed up with a bit of a ding on a triangle. Ding! For those of you who watch Blackadder, you'll know exactly what I mean. Blackadder goes forth. Whenever I hear a regiment band performing, I always expect them to finish with a baldric and a triangle at the very end. Now, that was, of course, Ride of the Valkyries, as played by, on the album, Rule Britannia, and it's Apocalypse Now is the film. Apocalypse Now. So that's the film that that they had, Ride of the Valkyries, with that direct connection to the army. Now, we are playing a ring-based song because we caught up with Lyndon Terracini earlier this week when he got appointed as the Artistic Director of Opera Australia, and I caught up with him to talk about the exciting news that we're going to have a staging in Australia. Now, I'm going to play the extended interview with Lyndon Terracini. It's he was very generous with his time, so thank you so much to Lyndon for that, and I hope you enjoy the interview. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. Lyndon Terracini is the biggest name in Australian opera right now. Described as the new son-in-law at Opera Australia, Lyndon has this week been named as the artistic director of the company. And he's already created a bit of an excitement with his vision for the company. Thanks for joining me, Lyndon.
It's a pleasure, Dan.
Now, you've created a bit of a stir already in the opera world with two simple words. Do you know what those two words were?
Well, I assume you're referring to The Ring.
Yeah, that would be it. Now, it's going to be quite an amazing feat to do.
Well, it will be. I've been down this track before when I was... I wanted to bring The Ring to the Brisbane Festival, actually, in 2006. And I spoke to Valery Gergiev in St. Petersburg about bringing the Mariinsky. And he'd agreed to do that. But through different sets of circumstances in Brisbane at the time, it wasn't possible. But I went and saw it in New York at the Met, actually. And it's the way they staged it was over four consecutive evenings with two casts, which is the way Wagner intended it to be staged. I don't think Wagner was thinking about two casts. He was very keen on making sure singers got a really hard workout. but it's a phenomenal experience at any time. But when you do see it over consecutive evenings, it's a phenomenal effect. And so I've always been keen to do it. And apart from anything else too, it's a phenomenal achievement, and some of the most beautiful music ever written at the end of Die Walküre is just extraordinary.
One of the things that I've noticed with the video announcement that was released when you were appointed into the role was you've got a huge love of opera, and it really came through in the video.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, well, I mean, it's been most of my life. I was a singer for 30 years, and as I've said to a few people, it wasn't only my profession, it's also my hobby. I don't play golf or do any of those things, so it's if I had a night off, then I would go to the theatre and see another opera. It's just always been a passion for me, and so it's fantastic to be able to continue that.
One of the things that people are interested in finding out is a little bit about the man behind the suit, I suppose, and we know about your work professionally, but there's a bit of mystery in the personal life, and I've done a bit of digging, and there's some different nicknames that you've been given over the past few years as well. The free range baritone.
Yes,
with the variations being, of course, the outback or the barbecue baritone.
Yes,
and
true.
Mandy Nolan at one point even called you the theatrical terrorist.
Yes. Well, there was a period where I was doing a lot of productions that were pretty extraordinary productions, actually, but quite controversial. Certainly the shows I did with Peter Greenaway and at the Netherlands Opera in Amsterdam, it was the first production he'd ever done in a theatre. And Peter Greenaway, as I'm sure those people who love his work in film will know, that he has an extraordinary eye, and he also has a great feeling for the big vision, the big story, melodrama, if you like. And so he was eminently suited to opera. And we did this piece in Amsterdam at the Netherlands Opera called Rosa, a horse drama. The music was by Louis Andriessen, with a fairly outrageous plot. Mm-hmm. But the images and the music were just extraordinary, and at every performance we would get standing ovations from the entire theatre, and people were sleeping outside to try and get in and so on. But his use of technology in terms of projecting film from the front and from the back and onto people's bodies and so on was really quite revolutionary at that time. It was in 1994. Mm. And he's been doing that sort of work for quite some time, so he's a master of it. And that was pretty exciting to do. So some of those productions that I was doing, people started giving me those sorts of nicknames, I think.
In terms of the nickname of the theatrical terrorist, I suppose that it comes from your versatility, your ability to shift from things like opera to theatre, and then even locations from Australia to Italy, or even going from performer to director.
Yeah.
When you've kind of been making those transitions, has it always been a sort of seamless and easy transition for you? Have you had to put a lot of effort into doing, to moving to Italy, for example, with your family?
Well, that came about because in 1976, I was singing this big piece at the Adelaide Festival called El Cimarron by the composer Hans Werner Henze. And it went very well, and so he invited me to go to the festival in Italy, in Montepulciano, that he was running at the time. And he'd written a new opera based on Don Quixote, or to be truthful, he'd adapted it from Paisiello's opera of the same name. So he asked me to sing Sancho Panza in that opera, which I did, and it was a fantastic experience. It was in the summer. It was in the main piazza in Montepulciano. It's sort of on a hill, and so they closed off all the streets that led to the piazza with big windmills, built a massive stage, and in fact there were two actors in the stage, and they used to arrive on stage in a Fiat 500 and get out of the Fiat 500 and start performing. And I had a huge aria to begin with 47 top Fs in it, which was pretty fun to sing. But my exit was down this ramp on a sort of type of a scooter, and I had to go up in the air, jettison the scooter, and land in a haystack, which was fantastic fun. And I remember on the first night I did this, and all these kids ran out of the audience to come over to see if I was okay. But I had a wonderful time, and so I thought that I'd like to go back to Italy, and I was singing with the Australian Opera, as it used to be known then, at the time. I was singing Guglielmo and Strefon and Mazzetto and all sorts of things, really. Sid in Albert Herring. I was the first Sid in that John Cox production. But I thought I wanted to go back and study, and so I found a teacher, and I went back for 3 months the next year, and then 3 months the year after that, and then decided that I'd like to live in Italy and work in Europe. So I moved over there then. So it was fairly seamless in that one thing led to another, and it sort of made my mind up for me. And I've always followed my instincts, and fortunately it worked out very well. And similarly with when I was asked to do a play, I've always been interested in the dramatic side of the theatre, and what that meant as for a singer. So that was I didn't find that such a great leap, really. It was more of a leap when I decided that I wanted to write this screenplay for a film. I adapted a series of poems by Les Murray that's called The Widower, and I sang the main character, not on screen, but most of the film takes place in people's minds. But it was writing the screenplay was a completely new experience, and so I had to write about, I think, 13 drafts of that screenplay to get it right. But it was a great learning experience, and focused me a lot more, I guess, on the text, and that, of course, stands you in good stead in opera, because there's the old debate, what's first, the text or the music, and so on and so on. So that experience too was part of my development, well, I guess as an artist, but also in terms of preparing, I guess, for this role as Artistic Director of Opera Australia, having all of those experiences is vitally important, I think.
Mm, I mean, there's things that we'd want to explore there. There's the sort of background, because you've come from an Italian background, of course.
Mm.
And when you say jumping over the stack with the scooter, it just reminds me of that great scene from The Great Escape.
Yes, exactly.
And I wonder if when you left Australia, if it felt like for you, if it was a great escape from Australia. I mean, being from regional Australia, I suppose, Lismore being your background in Australia. Did it feel like a great escape, or did it feel like you were coming, home to Italy?
Well, probably a combination of those things. I actually moved to Lismore after living in Italy.
Oh, okay.
I was born in Sydney and grew up in Sydney.
Right.
But it was, yeah, to answer your question, I think it was a combination of those things. It did feel tremendously liberating to go, and given that my great-grandfather was Italian, it was a sort of feeling of going back to your roots and discovering different things and the way you felt about a completely different culture. So I think at that time it was probably a combination of what I've just talked about, but nevertheless it was a wonderful period in my life, because I think I learnt a lot there, to speak Italian for a start, but also in terms of how opera is so much part of the culture in Italy. I mean, that sounds like an obvious thing to say, but we lived in a village right up on the Swiss border. And every summer, the villagers would hire a big bus, and they would all go to Verona, to the arena in Verona, for the opera season. And, you know, I found that quite extraordinary, that it was such a part of people's lives that they wouldn't think twice about getting on a bus and travelling hundreds and hundreds of kilometres to go to the opera.
So what was the sort of the cultural difference then for you when you came back to Lismore then, and you were working with, I suppose, regional cultural outlets where I know that when you first did touring for South Australia State Opera?
Yep, State Opera South Australia, yeah.
State Opera South Australia, yeah. When you were touring with them, you felt like you were doing opera to rednecks in Northern Territory.
Yeah, well, it was interesting that period. It was the first job I had that was longer than a month after I left the opera school in Sydney. I'd sung a number of performances with Young Opera, as it was in those days, in Sydney. And then Justin McDonnell was running a company called New Opera in South Australia, which was the predecessor of the State Opera Company. And he offered me a contract that went for a year, and I thought, oh, my God, how fabulous is this? And it was really interesting repertoire, in fact. I sang in the opening performance of the Space Theatre at the Adelaide Festival Centre, and it was Robin Archer's first performance in a music theatre production. And we did The Seven Deadly Sins. I also did The Telephone by Menotti there, and then we toured the Northern Territory doing both of those productions. And that was pretty wild. And then we also did a tour of South Australia from Ceduna on the edge of the Nullarbor Plain to border town on the Victorian border of Don Pasquale. And those were the old days when it was a lot of fun, actually, because you would sing the show, then you would, during the show, you would do all the set changes yourself, and then after the show you would pull the set down, put it into the back of the truck, then go home and try and get some sleep before getting up the next morning and going on the road and doing the same thing again. But having said that, it was wonderful training, being able to make mistakes out in the bush, try things out, learning how to pace roles. It was really a terrific experience, and I learned a lot by doing it.
You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9, and that was Schubert's Nachtlied number 2. And that was the song choice by Lyndon Terracini. We're in the middle of our interview highlights with Lyndon Terracini, and it's a beautiful song, and that one was done by Andreas Schiff and Peter Scherrier, and it's written by Schubert. And it was one of the choices that he had, one of two choices for a music track that he had, because we asked him to pick some tracks that meant something to him. And I wanted to just mention the fact that when I said rednecks in Northern Territory in the interview, that was a quote from a paper. I didn't mean that myself, because I've been to the Northern Territory, and that's certainly not a totally accurate observation at all. Now, I also wanted to say that I had a quick chat with Bill from Behind the Scenes, who was on air today with Bill and Vito and Penelope. Thanks, guys, for doing a great show today. We had a quick chat about Lyndon Terracini, and interesting that so many people are readily accepting him, which is fantastic. And it's probably to do with the fact that he is so good as a performer himself, but also he's got an excellent background as an artistic director as well. So it's very rare to have someone who can do both aspects of that management, I suppose. And it's very great to have seen him also come back to the organisation, having been with the Australian Opera back in the 70s as well. So he's a very clever man, and he's got a great love of opera, as I mentioned in the interview, and it's so true. It really comes across for me, and it's always great to see. So I'm going to continue with the interview highlights with Lyndon Terracini. You are on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9.
You've worked a lot with regional companies bringing performing arts to regional areas. Do you feel that there has been a sort of shift from the original thinking where it was kind of like you're pushing opera and culture onto a community? Do you feel that now it's actually readily accepted and welcomed?
Well, I think there are a few things with that. I set up a company in Lismore called Northern Rivers Performing Arts, and it was a very different model to a performing arts organisation in Australia at the time. And it was really based on the German system where you have an opera company, a theatre company, a dance company, and they bring productions in. Well, we weren't doing a lot of opera or dance or theatre in Lismore, although we did do dance, opera and theatre in every season, but it was the structure that I thought was really interesting. So we did that. We did a lot of new work. I commissioned an opera from Paul Grabowski called The Mercenary, and also from Elena Katz-Chernin, Mr. Barbecue. We had a lot of dance pieces that we commissioned, and some pieces where I wrote the text and music and directed them as well. But they were pieces that were really connected to the culture of that place, and I think people certainly responded to their own stories being told on stage in their own town. And when I was running the Queensland Music Festival, we did some big productions in Mount Isa. Both with Bobcats, and the first one was Bobcat Dancing and the second one was Bobcat Magic. And again, there were stories that were about Mount Isa, and it was using, obviously Bobcats and earth movers and excavators that were really part of everyday life in the mines and in general in Mount Isa. And so people related to those pieces incredibly strongly, and over three nights we had 18,000 people come to the shows in a town of 22,000. And so it was quite amazing to see how people did connect to a culture that they felt familiar with. And I think that's been a big shift in Australia, in that we do want to see our own stories. We want to see them on film. And there are a number of Australian films that have had an extraordinary effect, and I think the new one, Samson and Delilah, is in that category too. But I think in terms of opera as well, people are keen to see our stories told through the operatic form. That's not to say that the great masterpieces of the past aren't important to do. They are, and they're the lifeblood of any opera company, and vital to do them. And in fact, I love them. I would happily watch La Boheme every night of the week, and plenty of others too.
Yeah.
But I think the trick to it is having a balance, so that you can present those sorts of masterpieces, and at the same time perhaps introduce people to operas that are about the stories of our place, of our culture.
I mean, one of the goals that you've got for the company going forward is to commission new Australian works. I mean, I can't remember the last time we commissioned an Australian opera in the national company, but it's clearly something that, you know, is part of that whole need to tell your own stories.
Absolutely. I mean, there have been, Opera Australia certainly has commissioned Australian composers and presented their operas, but I think what I'd like to do is to have a clearly structured process in place so that you are regularly commissioning Australian composers to tell our stories through, as I said, the operatic medium, so that we would have a body of Australian work. And I think in the future too, it's important for Opera Australia to have that body in its repertoire, that body of Australian work. That's really what will help to define it too, I think.
Mm. In terms of the process, I mean, the Victorian Opera, for example, they commission a new work each year. Is that the sort of thing that Opera Australia will be looking towards? Or?
Yeah, I think so. It may not be every year, although I would like to do that. It would depend on how big the piece was, whatever else was in the season. And again, I talk about balance a lot. I think it's vastly important to have balance within the season, balance within the company, balance within the ensemble. And so I'd approach it from that aspect to make sure that everything we did had the correct balance.
Now, speaking of balance, balance between talk and music would be important. You've got a track that you've selected that I thought I'd ask you to tell us why you've picked it and why it means it's special to you.
There's the Improviso from Andrea Chenier, and there's a wonderful version that Franco Corelli sings. There's also a very old version that Gigli sings that's pretty exciting as well. And, you know, it's about a poet, and the language and the text is absolutely beautiful. And the music is extraordinary. It's really, it kind of encapsulates all of the things that I guess we love about opera, in that there's a gorgeous tune, a wonderful tenor singing with terrific high notes, great drama within it, sweetness within it, and the way the text and the music is married, I think makes it a really special piece.
You're currently still at the major Brisbane festivals because your role at Opera Australia doesn't start till about October.
Yeah, the end of October, yeah.
Yeah, and I know that Brisbane Festival is coming up very soon, and there's a launch for the program in the 8th of this month.
That's right, yes.
Are there any hints on what operatic works could be coming up this year?
Dan, you'll have to come to the launch in Brisbane, or come to the festival from September 12 till October 3. There is an opera, a contemporary opera that we are doing, which is a very unusual opera. It features a lot of Indigenous people, I can tell you that much, but anything else will have to be a surprise, but it's a very interesting piece.
One of the things that, as you're currently now working as an artistic leader within a major organisation, you're about to move into the National Opera Company, one of the things that I find reading about your work is that you've always been interested in having creative input, even if you're just a performer. You've always wanted to have a say in how things get run. Is this role, for example, something that you've been looking at doing for a long time?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting comment because I've always enjoyed being very involved in a production, even in the days when I was a singer. I found that if I could really connect to the production in all areas, then that helped me as a performer. To really be totally immersed in the piece and for it to be the complete focus of what I was doing. My wife always laments the fact that I don't like holidays. I just get bored on holidays. I have too much fun in my life. and I mean that seriously. I'm extremely fortunate to be able to do what I've always wanted to do, either as a singer or actor or director or now as an artistic director of Opera Australia. But having said that, with Opera Australia, it's there's a huge responsibility associated with that too, because of the company's great history, because of all of the wonderful artists that have performed with the company, and not only the artists, everyone who's worked there. It's an extraordinary family, and I've said that quite a bit. And I mentioned to the company the other morning, last Tuesday morning, when I spoke to them, that I felt like the prospective son-in-law being taken home to meet the family. and it really is that for people to work on that many different productions, that many different performances every year, and to give as much as they give, is a humbling thing to see. It's quite extraordinary, actually, and so I'm very much looking forward to being part of the family and contributing as much as I possibly can.
I mean, in terms of the family, it seems that there are a lot of people who are feeling a lot of relief with your appointment, considering that last year there was quite a significant amount of controversy, particularly over the letter that Fiona Jaynes wrote to the board about sort of mismanagement and different aspects about artistic standard falling last year within the company.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wasn't part of that, and I was certainly at a distance. I mean, as a sort of observer, and it pained me to see people obviously being so distraught. And as I said, there are often disagreements within families. Every family has disagreements. But as I said to the company the other day, if people do have an issue or they have some sort of problem, my door would always be open, and I encourage them to just come and talk to me. And, you know, we do what every family does, I guess, at some stage. You sit around the kitchen table and you work it out, and then hopefully you can move on. But I'm really conscious of, as I said before, of maintaining a balance and harmony within the organisation. Because if the organisation is happy, then the performances will be a hell of a lot better than if everyone's feeling miserable.
I think it was John Pringle who said in an interview that when the company works like a family, you can really feel it on stage and you can see it, and it just works wonderfully. And that interaction between performers is just that little bit more special.
Well, I think that's absolutely true, and John had a wonderful career, and when I was a young singer with the company, he was tremendously good to me, I must say, and very generous. He was a great member of that family too, because he really, I believe, understood what the ensemble meant to the company. And from the comments that you've just mentioned, that's absolutely clear. It's when the family is working as an ensemble, you can really do extraordinary things.
Now, in terms of talking about a family, I know that one of your goals is to sort of increase the family, or the extended family. There's an aspect of, I suppose, engaging new audiences.
Yeah, I think there are a few things with that, Dan. Firstly, when I was a young member of the company, almost all of the singers were resident artists. And that's changed dramatically over the years, where there are very few resident artists apart from the chorus. And I'd certainly like to increase the number of resident artists. I think that also helps the family and ensemble atmosphere. And in terms of new audiences, I'm very keen now on engaging with digital technology, primarily because it's a very exciting medium to work in. And also, too, because it's the language of young people. And if you're speaking that language, then you can converse with young people. If you're not speaking their language, then it's very difficult to have the same level of communication. I mentioned Peter Greenaway before and the sort of work that he's done with digital technology. But people like Bob Wilson, Robert Lepage now is doing a lot of work in that area. And I think it is important not only for the productions that you do in the theatre, but also the way the company communicates with its audiences in terms of, via websites and all of that. But there are some very smart things you can do now in those areas. I mean, YouTube and Twitter, obviously, but in a couple of years, Twitter won't be fashionable anymore. There'll be something else, and it's a matter of being able to keep up with that sort of development and being able to be in tune with it, so to speak, so that you can, as I said, speak the same language as young people.
I mean, the impressive thing was I didn't catch the story about your appointment through the traditional methods like the newspaper. I caught it via Emma Williams, your publicist. She tweeted it, so that's how I found out about it.
Yeah, well, exactly. We've spoken about it a bit, and as I said, that's the language that younger people engage with now, and we need to engage with it as well.
Recently in Sunday Arts, there was a nice little piece about the What Opera, which is a part of an engaging program for schools that is being run by Opera Australia. I mean, that's sort of another way of building young audiences by sort of getting them when they're in primary school and making opera much more accessible to them. Have you got other things that you're looking to do in order to engage young audiences?
Yeah, no, the example you're mentioning, it was terrific, actually. I think it was from Rockhampton in Queensland. And I think it's vitally important that people have a relationship with opera, with classical music from a very early age. If they grow up with it being a part of their lives, then they have a special relationship with it. I think in that respect we can learn a lot from soccer or football, as they call it now. There are more kids under seven playing soccer than any other sport in Australia. And once they do start playing, they may not play for Australia, very, very few of them will, but they grow up to be fans, and they'll buy tickets and they'll go and watch other people play in the World Cup and so on. And I think we need to develop that sort of connection so that even if most of the people who we're connecting with in schools don't end up being singers or musicians, they will have a very deep understanding of it and therefore a very strong relationship to it, and then they become fans and they buy tickets and come to the theatre.
Now, what will be the first season that you have a direct influence on, Lyndon?
It'll be 2012.
And so The Ring is going to be one of the things, of course, that you'll be looking for. Is
well,
it going to be aimed for 2012? Or?
I'd certainly like to aim at starting it at around about that period. Obviously with The Ring, you need a lot of lead time because particular singers, particularly a Siegfried, they're very difficult to find. And obviously, if we're doing it, we would want to have the best people. So, once we've got all that lined up, we'll go for it.
Well, I look forward to seeing what is in store for Opera in 2012. Thank you so much for spending your time with us, Lyndon.
It's a pleasure, Dan. Nice to talk to you.
You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9, and we had just then our interview highlights with Lyndon. Excuse me, Lyndon Terracini. It's very exciting to hear that we are going to get a staging of the Ring Cycle. It's fantastic. It's one of the operas that it's huge. I think there's only been one staging in recent times, in the 80s in Adelaide. And I think that there's been in Sydney they've tried, in Melbourne they've tried, as Lyndon suggested, in Brisbane they thought about it. And it's so huge. It just hasn't been done in Australia that often. So to hear that it is coming, it is quite a huge, I just get to be really excited, really. Now, something that got me really excited about classical music in general, I don't know if I should play this track first and then explain or whether I should explain it and then play it, but I will explain a little bit and then play it and then explain the rest of it. It's a track that only recently have I just realized that it is the moment where I got interested in classical music. And I want to share it with you today because it is special. I've got the album. It is in a beautiful leather-bound cover, and it's got a beautiful little booklet, and it was something that I bought after watching it on Lord of the Rings. Funny that the Lord of the Rings would interest you in classical music, you might say, and what does it have to do with opera? Well, the indirect connection is, of course, there is The Ring Cycle by Wagner, and then there is The Lord of the Rings. we're about to go into sketchy connection territory, but it's not so sketchy because there's been some suggestion that in, what is it, Der Ring des Nibelung, which is the Ring Cycle from Wagner, there's a lot of use of leitmotifs and that sort of thing. And leitmotifs, spelt L-E-I-T, motifs, is a German word that, it connects characters and objects and situations. It's musical themes that connect to characters or objects or situations. And it basically sort of tells us a story without words. And in The Lord of the Rings, there's a lot of that music as well, written by Howard Shore. There's a lot of those leitmotifs used alongside characters as well. And I want to play you this next piece of music. And it's from the scene from The Bridge of Khazad Dûm. I'll play it and then I'll explain the rest of it for you very shortly. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. Actually, before I do play it, I want you to basically, I should lay out the scene so that you can reference it in the film. It's the moment when the Balrog and Gandalf are on the bridge together, and Gandalf does the big, you cannot pass. They have the bridge breaks and the Balrog collapses and falls into the pits of hell, as you presume they are. And it has a whip on it, and it captures Gandalf just in the very last second, and Gandalf too falls into this pit. And actually, the quote for this week is he holds onto the bridge for a little bit, and he says to the hobbits, "Fly, you fools!" So that can be the fool quote for this week. And so the hobbits run out, and they are very sad that Gandalf has just died before their eyes. And so what you'll hear is you'll hear these bass drums and the taiko drums as well, this boom, 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 which is the battle between Gandalf and the Balrog, and this beautiful moment of silence, or just slight second of silence, and this beautiful voice, and I'll play that for you now. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9.
The Fool and the Opera, putting opera in the washing machine until the old person smell is gone.
You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9, and that is the moment that I became interested in classical music. That voice is a sensationally beautiful voice. And if you remember the film, that, of course, comes at the slight second where you could see the hobbits have just crawled out of the caves, or the caves of Moria, and they're crying, they're lamenting the loss of Gandalf. And and it's such a... It was... a piece of music that really, it moved me. The visuals, of course, and also just the shock of having a very big fight scene, and then just that silence, and then that beautiful voice just coming, for me it was coming out of nowhere, and it was very moving. And the interesting thing is I did some quick looking up for that particular voice, wanting to know who it was, and it was listed on the album that I've got as Mabel Fale Tulu. And the interesting thing is I couldn't find any more information about it. Researching her, to no avail did I find any more information about her. Interestingly enough, she has changed her name, and that's the cryptic hint was you will find the voice bearer somewhere in the West. And interestingly enough, it is in Western Australia where you'll find her. Her name at the moment is Avale Cole, or Avale Cole. I'm not sure which one it is, but she's actually one of our leading sopranos in Australia at the moment. She was greatly celebrated when she's got a very beautiful lyric soprano voice. And she's won all sorts of awards already in New Zealand and in Australia. And Madame Butterfly, when she performed it in the Free Opera in the Park event in Perth, it was just one of the most celebrated productions that they've had in a long time. And of course, she's currently, or she most recently performed as Aida as well in the opera of the same title. So a beautiful piece of music and a beautiful singer. And it's great to see that she's now an Australian. Now, I wanted to just continue very quickly about the discussion about leitmotifs, just to sort of give you a deeper understanding of it. And I'm going to use tracks from The Lord of the Rings because, well, it's music that you're already familiar with. One day we might look at Das Nibelung and explore the leitmotifs in that. But for the time being, I'm going to use familiar music to you just to show you how it can be used. For example, if you think about Gollum or Sméagol in the film, there's two themes that they use for Howard Shore uses for Sméagol. One is the pity theme, when Sméagol, you need to, you know, sort of think of him as a victim of the ring, and then the other when he's Gollum and he's a threat to the hobbits. So this is the Sméagol pity theme. And, of course, we'll follow it up with the Gollum menacing theme as well, so you kind of get a feel for the difference. It's got almost a bit of a Jaws-esque feel to it, doesn't it? And, you know, when you hear those two different leitmotifs, basically it's explaining the difference between the split personality of Gollum. But, you know, there's also some very obvious themes as well, where you kind of get the Ringwraiths get a very dark, choral sort of, almost, what is it, when a Requiem-based theme.
The Fool and the Opera.
And that theme we just played there was actually the nature theme. So it's interesting that, you know, things, it doesn't necessarily have to be a character-based theme either. So that nature theme there was sung by Edward Ross, who's a beautiful, got a beautiful, clear voice, boy soprano as well. So that's some ways of showing you how a leitmotif can work. So I'm going to just lead out now with a bit more Edward Ross, I think. I'm going to play the last section of There and Back Again, which is another favourite from the film itself. So that has been our little encapsulation of The Ring and The Ring. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. Well, that has been another episode for another week. So thank you so much for joining me again today. Now, I want to say thank you so much to Kirsten. This is going to be her last episode on Bent Notes for a little while. Eric Williams is going to continue next week, but please do stick around for another 2 hours of wonderful jazz with Kirsten. It's been lovely having Kirsten follow me for quite a while. It's, she's become, she's become a lovely friend, and it's also great to have a bit of opera banter with her and a bit of jazz banter with her every now and then. So thank you so much for everything that you've done, Kirsten, and I look forward to seeing you again maybe in a season's time. All right, well, that's it for us for today. I'll catch you next week, as Edward Ross would probably say. Same Fledermaus time, same Fledermaus channel.
Thanks for listening to the Joycast of The Fool and the Opera from Joy 94.9. You can find more Joycasts and the program blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera. The Fool and the Opera is produced by Dan Vo and Jed Gilbert thanks to the support of Joy sponsors and members. Please help support it by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with Joy.